Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in German Studies. I'm Ryan Stackhouse. Today, we're joined by Robert Gerwarth. Professor Gerwarth, as some of you will already be aware, has made a name for himself in the study of interwar revolutions and radicals. As an author of a previous biography about the life of Reinhard Heydrich and a second book on the post-war chaos that swept the continent with the vanquished, the events of 1917 to 1923 have become something of a specialty for him. His latest book, November 1918, The German Revolution, returns to these years with a focus on the oft-forgotten revolution that accompanied the tumultuous birth of the Weimar Republic. November 1918, available from Oxford University Press as of August this year, entreats us to take the revolution on its own terms rather than dismissing it as a way station on the road to 1933. Gerwarth synthesizes mountains of research in November 1918 with a beautifully crafted narrative that traces events through the eyes of contemporaries. So, if you only have time to read one book on the subject, make it this one. But enough from me. We have the man himself with us here today. So without further ado, Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Ryan. And also, of course, for the kind introduction.
Well, it's our pleasure to have you. Before we get to the book, how did you come to the study of history?
Well, that's a big question. I think it was in some ways a result of my upbringing in Berlin. I grew up in Berlin in the 1980s and 1990s. And with all that history surrounding you there, it was very difficult not to get interested in the subject matter. So I was there when the wall fell and experienced the end of the Cold War and the following decades, which was quite exciting to be there. And it was one of those events where you really felt that you were living through a historically important time period. But I had already been quite interested in history as a child. It was my favorite subject at school. So I think these events simply reinforced an interest that was already there.
I was interested to read in the preface that this was such a long-standing project for you over the course of your other publications. How did you come to write November 1918 specifically, and how did it evolve over time in light of your other work in the field?
Yeah, it's interesting. Actually, my very first history seminar at university was on the Weimar Republic. The subject has never really lost its fascination for me. So I've been thinking about Weimar, about German history within its broader European context for many, many years. But as is the case very often, and I'm sure many other authors will be able to sympathize with that, over the course of working on this project, I've been sidetracked with other projects, but also, of course, with teaching and life more generally. So I ended up writing other books. The November 1918 book was actually contracted well over 10 years ago. And I never really lost sight of it, but it just happened to be the case that I ended up publishing The Vanquished beforehand. And in some ways, I actually benefited from that delay because The Vanquished paints a much broader canvas in terms of geographical scope, but it also allowed me to think a bit about what makes German history special or unique and what is actually a reflection of wider trends in European history at the time. So that's how the delay happened. But I'm very glad that I ended up finishing the book now.
With that in mind, what is it that you want readers to take away from this?
Well, as you already indicated in the introduction, I think it's very important that we think of Weimar history on its own terms. Now, obviously, this book is only focused on the origins of the Weimar Republic, on the revolution itself. But it seems curious that we teach our students in history tutorials, basically in their first year, that we should not read history backwards. But when it comes to the Weimar Republic, we tend to make an exception. It is very often seen as a prehistory of the Nazi period, because, of course, we who were fortunate enough to be born after the Second World War, we all know how the story ends in 1933. And I think that has led to people looking for the origins of the Nazi dictatorship in previous periods of German history, be it in Imperial Germany or be it in the Weimar Republic. I'm trying to argue here, and others have made that point as well, that at least up until 1929, until the beginning of the Great Depression, the future of the Weimar Republic is wide open, with failure as likely as consolidation. Certainly, if you look at the general elections in 1928, the Nazis have an election result of less than 3%, whilst the Social Democrats return to government. So at that point, it really looks as if the consolidation process of the first German democracy has worked out. They have come through more crises than any other democracy in modern times. Putsch attempts from the left and the right, political violence on the streets, hyperinflation, the kind of issues that most democracies are not familiar with. And it is quite remarkable, I find, that the Weimar Republic survives all that.
With these larger questions in mind, you begin looking at 1917 as a sort of sea change moment in the war that begins framing expectations on both the left and the right. What happens that is so important in 1917, and what effect are these events having?
Well, this is exactly where world history comes into German history, and I think it's very difficult to explain the so-called revolution of expectations that happens in Germany and elsewhere in 1917 without two momentous events, the Russian Revolution, of course, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the entry of the United States into the war. Now, these both events really kind of changed the course of the war, but also the expectations for the world after the war is finished. Certainly those on the political left are hopeful, once the Bolshevik Revolution has been successful, that a revolution in Germany is also only a question of time. They're not necessarily Bolsheviks. Many people on the far left see, like Rosa Luxemburg, for example, actually view the Bolshevik Revolution with skepticism. But of course, they are in favor of a revolution in Germany. On the other hand, you have lots of middle-class people, but also the Social Democrats themselves, who are much more skeptical about whether or not it is possible to have a proletarian revolution in a highly industrialized country. It is worth bearing in mind that 1918 is the only successful revolution in a highly industrialized society prior to the peaceful revolutions that brought about the end of the Cold War. So this is quite a complex society, and many Social Democrats feel that the workers have more to lose than just their chains. And they therefore argue in favor of reform rather than revolution in Germany. On the other hand, the entry of the United States into the war, of course, also changes its course, in the sense that the German military leadership realizes that in order to win the war, it has to be won very quickly. This changes the strategy. It leads to the Spring Offensive, which, of course, then proves to be the undoing of the German army. The idea is to defeat the French and the British before American troops arrive in Europe in large numbers. And it is possible because the Russian Revolution, but also the military successes of the Germans on the Eastern Front essentially knocked Russia out of the war. So as a result of that, Ludendorff decides on a gamble, and as we all know, he loses that gamble. But there are expectations in Germany, quite widespread expectations at the beginning of 1918, that they're going to win this war, which of course then contrasts in a very stark way with the realities. And it also kind of gives energy to the stab in the back myth, in the sense that in November 1918, there's not a single Allied soldier on German soil. So even though it is clear, even to the military commanders, that Germany had been defeated militarily, it doesn't really make sense to many Germans in late 1918. And so therefore, they willingly buy into this narrative that it was not the enemy armies, but actually the enemy within communists in particular, but also Jews, who had conspired to bring about the downfall of the mighty German Empire. So lots of different expectations in Germany at the time as a result of these historical events that were outside of Germany, but that had an immediate effect on the ways in which people viewed the future.
Well, Russian capitulation and the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk especially pushes Ludendorff into this gamble in a race against time against American intervention. Where does the crisis of legitimacy that he is facing, and the government, the imperial government more broadly, is facing, stem from? And how are events in Russia feeding these impossibly high expectations?
Well, in many ways, Ludendorff and Hindenburg at this point had established a military dictatorship in Germany. They were really making the decisions, and the successes in Russia, the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, seemed to prove to many people that this strategy was working. And then as soon as the military success stopped in the spring and early summer of 1918, that's the moment when this regime, whose legitimacy really depends on military success, just like any charismatic leader, that's the turning point when really they kind of lose the confidence of the troops. And with the reversal of military fortunes on the Western Front, that intensifies to the point where most field commanders in the summer of 1918, are clearly unwilling to back the regime of the Kaiser any further. There is, of course, in November, the famous meeting of field commanders, where the vast majority essentially say to the military leaders that if the Kaiser decides to march on Berlin, he could not really count on the army, which is a huge disappointment for him.
Military collapse in the fall of 1918 here brings this underlying crisis of legitimacy that's been deferred by the expectations of peace with Russia to a head. You identify flagging discipline, a crumbling authoritarian government, and mounting pressure from the Entente as the catalyst for the revolution proper. What is the course of events that's bringing us into the fall?
Well, the revolution starts, and this is not dissimilar to the February Revolution in Russia. It really starts as protests, as a form of protest against the continuation of war. It's an anti-war revolution. And of course, the catalyst for it is the decision of the naval leadership to send out the Imperial Fleet in a last-ditch battle against the British. Many of the sailors obviously realized that this is a suicide mission, and the Imperial Army had been idle for most of the war. There is a mutiny, and this mutiny gradually spreads through the coastal cities and then inland, which makes the German Revolution quite unique, because generally revolutions start in the capital and then spread out through the country. Here, it really is in coastal towns like Kiel that the revolution begins. And in a way, the demands of the revolutionaries become more radical as the Kaiser refuses to give way immediately. Many of your listeners will, of course, know that the Kaiser is still refusing to abdicate in the early morning hours of the 9th of November. At this point, the revolution has basically overrun every German state except for the capital. And the Chancellor then finally takes the decision to announce the abdication without Wilhelm's approval.
You have this wonderful line tucked away in your chapter on the Kiel Mutiny, where you refer to the mutineers as, quote, 40,000 heavily armed men with naval artillery. Definitely casts it in sharp relief. There's also this metaphor as you talk about the oil slick of revolution from one of the contemporaries that leaves Berlin as this island in a sea of revolution, as it were. When it finally does come to Berlin, how does this happen?
Well, the imperial government, and in particular the military commanders in Berlin, were strangely confident that they could actually stop the revolution in Berlin. Lots of troops had been amassed in the city. There are, of course, garrisons around Berlin as well, in Potsdam. And they felt confident that with violence, if necessary, they could stop the revolution from succeeding in the capital. And many supporters of the Kaiser, there weren't many left at this point, but those hardliners in the military headquarters in Spa in Belgium felt quite confident that the revolution could be crushed with military power. So they were quite surprised, though, when they realized that some of the units which were deemed to be the most loyal in the city essentially capitulated and joined the revolutionaries without firing a shot. So one of the characteristics of the early phase of the revolution really is that it was remarkably peaceful. Not many people die during that revolution, which in some ways you could say has actually contributed to the assumption that this is a revolution in a minor key. It sort of lacks the drama and the violence and the blood spilling of the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution. So clearly there is a lot less drama, but I don't think that a peaceful revolution is necessarily an unsuccessful revolution.
This maximalist versus minimalist interpretation of a revolution, do you want to expand on that a little?
Sure. Yes, I'm very happy to. I think that our focus on the French and Russian revolutions, in particular the Great Revolution of the East and the Great Revolution of the West, at least within Europe, has led us to a situation in which lesser revolutions are very often overlooked, despite the fact that one could argue that both the Russian Revolution and the French Revolution end in bloodshed, civil war, and eventually dictatorships without that taking anything away from their historical greatness. I don't really believe in the maximalist assumption that violence is a key aspect of a successful revolution. I think success needs to be measured against what the revolutionaries themselves wanted. And the majority of the revolutionaries in Germany in November 1918 want two things. They want to end the war, which they do very quickly. And secondly, they want democratization. Now, there is, of course, disagreement on what the end result of that revolution should be. But it is worth bearing in mind that at least in November 1918, the vast majority of Germans want a democracy. And I think the election results of the National Assembly, January 1918, show that very clearly. It's only a very small minority of people who support the, even within the working class movement, which of course is split into the majority social democrats and the independent social democrats. But the majority social democrats, Ebert and his colleagues, have far more support than the independents, which are further to the left. And that can very clearly be shown, not just in that one particular election, but also for most, that's true for most elections throughout the 1920s when we take the KPD results into consideration.
If we circle back now to the revolution arriving in Berlin, what are the underlying tensions between the different factions of the Socialist Party on the one hand and the other visions that are competing for Germany's future before we arrive at the Spartacus uprising?
Yeah, the major tension, the major division is between the independent Social Democrats and the majority Social Democrats, who of course had split already during the war because of disagreement over whether or not a working class party should support the war credits or whether they should favor international working class solidarity. That is one of the key aspects that leads to the schism within the German working class movements. The other one is, of course, the question whether a revolution is necessary or not. Already since the beginning of the 20th century, some social democratic theorists had argued that a revolution is no longer necessary. It remains in the political program of the SPD, but the reference to revolution is predominantly rhetorical. There are other questions. Should a revolution lead to something that is similar to the proletarian dictatorship established in Russia? Or are we looking at a society which can be improved through reform? It is, I think, also worth bearing in mind here as the background to this discussion that the situation of workers in Russia is fundamentally different in 1917 from the situation of workers in Germany at the time. The Tsarist regime is an oppressive regime. It had crushed the revolution in 10 years earlier with extreme violence. Workers were living in often horrific conditions. And the situation for workers in Germany is fundamentally different. So the question is, do you need a radical revolution, or is it sufficient to further improve on what had already been achieved?
As these events and tensions are playing out in Berlin, the armistice is being negotiated with the Western powers by Erzberger. Who is involved in these negotiations? How are they playing out? And of course, what is the reception back home in Germany?
Yeah, many Germans, of course, have high hopes for the peace agreement, even for the armistice, particularly for the armistice, because they believe that this will be an armistice along the lines of the Wilsonian 14 points, that Germany will obviously have to make some concessions, but that at the end of the day, this will be a just peace, a peace without winners and losers. And so there is a naivety, I would say, among the general population. And here, once again, it is worth bearing in mind that for many Germans, particularly the more nationalistic-minded ones, it looked as if Germany was about to win the war as late as spring 1918. And suddenly they're facing demands that go well beyond what Wilson had put into the 14 points. Now, from the start, it is clear that the negotiations at the end of the First World War aren't really negotiations. Essentially, Erzberger is handed a catalogue of demands and is given a bit of time to accept these demands. So that obviously doesn't help. You can understand where the Allies are coming from. Also regarding their decision to continue the economic blockade of Germany, which of course leads to mass starvation, they want to enforce compliance, whereas the Germans see it as vindictiveness against the civilian population. So there is some suspicion, of course, in the Allied camp regarding how democratic the new government is. And it is a bit unfair because people like Erzberger and other people who are now in government had been behind the peace resolution the previous year, which essentially demanded a peace without territorial concessions. And these people are now in power, but nonetheless, they are viewed as representatives of the bygone regime. So there's a conflation of these different groups. And as soon as the terms of the armistice break in Germany, there's growing disillusionment. But nonetheless, certainly until 1919, the late spring, early summer 1919, when the peace terms become fully known, we're entering into what is generally referred to in the secondary literature as the dream period of the armistice, essentially a period where people had illusions about the kind of peace that peace treaty that Germany was going to sign.
During this dream period, Ebert's government is faced with the unenviable tasks of negotiating this unfavorable peace, reintegrating millions of disgruntled soldiers into an economy that is geared for war, securing food for a starving population that has produced the crisis in the first place, and finding some kind of public narrative that renders this near inconceivable sacrifice palatable. The consequences for all this are presumptively civil war. How is the transitional government handling these challenges, and what considerations are entering play?
Yeah, the challenges for this inexperienced government under Ebert are enormous. I mean, just to pick up one of the points that you just mentioned, there are still several million German soldiers scattered all over Europe. These are heavily armed men. The government has no idea how they will respond to the news of a revolutionary government. All of this is pretty challenging. You have to find the logistics to bring these people back, often march them back, make sure that you can collect as many arms as possible, because you don't necessarily want millions of men with war experience and firearms under their beds. And you have to feed them as well in a time when the economic blockade is still ongoing. So these are very practical challenges that the government is initially facing. And on top of that, of course, is the ideological divide between the independents and the majority social democrats, which is temporarily bridged in this moment of revolution. But there's always a risk that the situation will escalate, and that they will not find a long-term common denominator upon which common government policy will be possible. So the initial months are characterized by pragmatism, and also by, of course, Ebert's desire to prevent a social revolution. I mean, he himself, under the impression of the Russian Revolution, says repeatedly that he hates revolution like sin. What he means is he hates a Bolshevik-style revolution in which he feels a relatively small subsection of the population that never had a mandate from the overall majority of the electorate, essentially uses the chaotic situation, pushes against a legitimate government, and takes over power. And he sort of saw Liebknecht and Luxembourg as representatives of a Bolshevik-style government. While there are more nuances to all of this, Liebknecht in particular, of course, does very little to dispel that myth. I mean, he himself, his rhetoric is quite aggressive. He repeatedly praises the Soviet government and suggests that Germany must form an alliance with them. One of his first demonstrations after his release from prison ends outside the Soviet embassy in Berlin. So there are lots of references that make people like Ebert nervous, shall we say.
These unresolved tensions between the majority and independent socialist parties, stemming in large part from the move away from a council republic toward a national assembly, finally boil over in winter 1918-19. This leads to a conflict between the two socialist parties on the one hand and the Spartacists and the Freikorps on the other. Who are the key players here, and what is at stake in each of their political visions?
Yeah, in some ways, the clash that eventually happens in January 1919, and then, of course, drags on and happens again and again in different parts of Germany, is a result of irreconcilable ideological positions. On the one hand, you have people like Luxemburg and Liebknecht who feel that the revolution that they aspire to has been betrayed by the Social Democrats, in particular Ebert and Noske. And on the other hand, you have Ebert and Noske thinking that there are subversive groups who want to do what the Bolsheviks have done in Russia in 1917. And in addition to that, you have the Freikorps paramilitary organizations, mainly composed of decommissioned officers and NCOs, plus army cadets and nationalist students, who actually buy into this narrative that the revolution has betrayed the sacrifices of the German nation and the German military for the previous 4 years. So they are waiting for a situation where for a big reckoning, essentially. And essentially in the situation, Noske decides that in order to defeat what he perceives to be the greater enemy, namely the far left, he is willing to essentially make a deal with military units that are, of course, at no point behind the new democratic order. So there is a kind of Faustian pact. Now, up until that point, the Ebert government had always tried to seek compromises between the unions and the employers, also between the old army and the new government, in order to make sure that there wouldn't be a civil war in Germany. And I think it would be fair to Ebert to suggest that he was convinced that he was doing the right thing. He is not supportive of the Freikorps because he feels that the Freikorps are a good thing. But he feels more threatened by the far left. And at this point, this is not in any way, shape, or form to justify the extremely brutal suppression of the uprising in January 1919, or subsequently the crushing of the Munich Soviet Republic or other smaller council republics that spring up in various parts of Germany. But I think it is important to take more seriously than we have in the past the perspectives of contemporaries. And I think if you do that, it perhaps becomes clearer why Ebert panics in this situation.
How so? Just expand on that a little.
Well, I mean, the main reason, once again, why Ebert is viewing the Spartakists sort of on the far left of the independence, on the communist left, with such suspicion is because of events in Russia the previous year. So that's what he has in mind. He has in mind that you don't actually need a large number of supporters. What you need is a group of determined revolutionaries, professional revolutionaries, who are willing to overthrow a democratically sanctioned government. So he thinks that the Spartakists are doing precisely that. Now, that is probably unfair to Rosa Luxemburg in particular, because they don't necessarily want a Soviet-style regime. But in the heat of the moment, I'm not quite sure that there is space for these subtleties from the point of view of Ebert and Noske in particular. So different people come to this moment with very different expectations, which is, of course, characteristic for the entire Weimar period. There are irreconcilable ideological divides that cannot be bridged. But as soon as these massacres have taken place, the original accusation of treason against the Social Democrats, that the Social Democrats had betrayed the revolutionary cause, whilst at the same time being accused by nationalists of betrayal of the German nation for supporting the revolution in the first place, this really creates a toxic climate, because now the Social Democrats are confronted with accusations of treason from both sides. And so the divide between the different factions within the working class movements becomes deeper and deeper. And to the point where in 1929, of course, also under the influence of Moscow, the KPD essentially decides that it will be impossible going forward to work together with the Social Democrats, which has dramatic consequences because if we look at, say, the Kapuch of 1920, when the different parties, working class parties in Germany, decided to back a general strike against the putschists, you can see what working class grassroots, how strong working class grassroots support in Germany is, because the strike essentially brings all of Germany to a grinding halt, and the putsch collapses within days. But no such response is possible in January 1933, when, of course, the economic situation is very difficult as well, and lots of people are unemployed and are desperately looking for jobs. So having a general strike in that climate would have been a challenge, even for a united front of SPD and KPD. But nonetheless, I think it is worth remembering where these tensions, growing tensions, are coming from.
Circling back again to the November 1918 to summer 1919 dreamland period, even the Spartacus uprising fails to upset this enthusiasm for democratization in the broader population. What is the legislative vision that is emerging during this period, and how is it being legitimized in the face of this resistance from extremes on both sides?
Well, essentially, in that spirit of broader collaboration between the largest working class party in Germany, the SPD, the MSPD, and the some of the more liberal middle class parties and the Catholic Center Party, the idea is to bring people from all of these parties together to draft a liberal constitution. What is interesting here is that the liberals, although they are much smaller in terms of seats, actually have a huge influence on the constitution, which is why you basically get the results that you get. It's not a social democratic constitution, but much more of a liberal vision of how a constitution should be written. Of course, very important aspects of general legislation, but also the constitution, is full equality between men and women. Of course, the women's right to vote was already introduced in the lead up to the National Assembly elections in January 1919, making Germany the first highly industrialized country to have to give women the vote, which is actually very important because up until that point, more than half of the population had been excluded from the process of political decision making. And it is also important because, as a result of the demographic changes introduced by the war, the fact that 2 million German young men had died, that means that there is a female surplus in the population. And I think that has generally been, well, not overlooked, but it hasn't been highlighted enough, I would say, in general histories of this period. Because ultimately, when you read general histories of the Weimar Republic, you get the impression that this is a very male republic, when really it's women who decide the elections, which I think is quite remarkable. Now, they remain underrepresented in parliament, but that doesn't mean that women are not politically engaged. In fact, in most elections, you have far more women going to the polls than men. So I think that is something that needs to be more strongly emphasized. In terms of... there has been always been a lot of kind of criticism of some articles in the Weimar Constitution, notably, of course, Article 48, which gives the president, as a kind of Ersatzkaiser, the right to rule by decree in times of emergency. And of course, this comes up once again because we look at the history of the Weimar Republic through the prism of 1933, when Hindenburg uses his exceptional powers to appoint Adolf Hitler as chancellor of a coalition government. But what is, I think, less well known is that Ebert, as president of the Republic, actually uses Article 48 quite extensively, but in the aim, with the aim and ambition to safeguard the revolution during the turbulent first couple of years. So it is not necessarily a tool that is was automatically designed to undermine democracy, but rather something that was aimed as a sort of safeguard. Now, moving forward to 1945, obviously people felt that this was one of the reasons why the Weimar Republic collapsed, but I don't think that's the case. I mean, if you look at the election results, and I think that this is generally a point worth making, in democracies, of course, there is the possibility, the inherent possibility that people decide that they no longer want a democracy, and therefore support political parties which work towards the abolition of democracy. And I mean, we're seeing that. I don't want to draw extreme parallels to the present, but what we're seeing at the moment in various parts of the world is that political parties that are not necessarily supportive of democracy in its purest form, but rather prefer a kind of managed democracy or authoritarian form of government, are gaining ground again. And it is perhaps worth bearing in mind that you know, democracies can fail, they can self-abolish, and often with terrible consequences.
The framing of this new constitution by the National Assembly, as you quite rightly point out, does not end the latent threat of revolution and opposition from those who are not in favor of a democracy. The dreamland is quite rudely dispelled by an escalating spiral of violence that begins in late spring. What happens during the second phase of the revolution?
Well, the second phase of the revolution is essentially marks a radicalization, a departure from the peaceful first phase of the revolution. It probably already starts in December 1918, but certainly escalates in the spring of 1919. And what happens here is that you have a variety of localized uprisings by far-left groups that are unhappy with the results of the revolution. They say, okay, we have a democracy, but we don't have no elements of direct democracy, since the Social Democrats, in cahoots with the Liberals and the Centre Party, decided against introducing elements of the council republic and instead preferred an indirect democracy. They feel that the revolution has been betrayed and that certain opportunities were not, explored in greater detail. And this kind of escalates into violence. In tandem with that, roughly at the same time, of course, on the 18th of January, the Paris Peace Conference convenes. So the process of undermining democracy is not just an internal problem. I'd say it's also an external problem. Now, I'm not saying that the Versailles Treaty is responsible for the undoing of Weimar democracy, but it didn't help either. Now, I can't really see any other outcome, because certainly when you compare the Versailles Treaty with some of the other peace treaties, be they the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, but also Trianon, I would almost argue that Versailles was one of the milder peace treaties, and anything less harsh would have been impossible for these statesmen, for Wilson and many others, to sell to their home populations, particularly in France and Britain, where the numbers of casualties had been very high. So I think there are internal developments and also external developments that really put the democratic center in Germany under extreme pressure. That said, they still maintain a majority for a while, not as clear a majority as they had in January 1919, but one of the central points I'm trying to make is that Weimar is not just a lesson in that democracies can fail, but also a reminder that democracies can be very resilient in the face of extraordinary challenges. So again, you have these challenges ranging from a huge debt burden already before the reparations question is put on the table. You have radicalism on the far left and far right, people who cannot be reconciled with democracy. You then have, on top of that, foreign occupation in 1923. You have putsch attempts, be it the Kapp-Putsch in 1920 or the Hitler-Putsch in 1923. And on top of that, hyperinflation. And despite it all, the Weimar Republic actually continues to exist until 1933.
Well, we finally do arrive at the poison chalice, the Treaty of Versailles. What are the perspectives coming to the table? You've alluded to some of them already, but more importantly, what are the effects of redrawing these boundaries across Europe?
Yeah, essentially what happens in November 1918, and then what is sanctioned by the Paris Peace Conference, often retrospectively, is probably the most dramatic reshuffling of the European map. Now, I think it is important to remind people that very often these realities were already created in November 1918, when the big land empires in Europe collapsed and a very large number of new independent states emerged in the shatter zones of empire. And essentially, these new borders were created with violence, paramilitary groups who suddenly defined themselves as the new national armies. So the Western allies don't really have any troops in Eastern and Central Europe, which leads to the strange situation that very often they have to ask the German troops to stay where they are in order to kind of control the situation. Obviously, Germany, or many Germans, expected fully that the country would lose its colonies, and also fully expected that there would be changes to the German western border. The loss of Alsace-Lorraine was fully anticipated. And then in addition to that, there was the much more controversial issue of the German eastern border. And that was never accepted, the new drawing of the German eastern border, the bleeding frontier, as it is often called, and the emergence of an independent Poland. That remained a very thorny issue for a very long time, in addition, of course, to the creation of very sizable ethnically German minorities in East Central Europe, which becomes a sort of major topic, of course, for Nazi propaganda in the 1930s.
The issues that you're raising in this book, concepts of authoritarian resilience and democratic failure, are, of course, becoming much more hotly debated in other literatures. You have this epilogue that draws attention to how the Republic, as you say, weathered the storm from 1920 to 1923, arguing that a lack of assertiveness about its successes had more to do with upset expectations than any problems or failures to improve circumstances. You conclude on this note that as of late 1923, consolidation would have seemed more likely than failure. Talk us through, how so?
Well, after the major state crisis of 1923, which saw Belgian Franco occupation, which saw the collapse of the currency, hyperinflation, and many other sort of major crises that we already talked about, it seemed as if the Republic had weathered the storms. And as I said at the onset, one of the premises of the book is to take more seriously the views of the contemporaries. So for the contemporaries, who obviously could not know how the story would end, it would have looked at the end of 1923 as if the future was finally going to be brighter. And I would extend that argument and basically say the same thing until the summer of 1929, when in 1928, for example, the Social Democratic Chancellor, who had just been re-elected, Hermann Müller, published an account of the November Revolution, basically celebrating the event and said, look, how far we have come. 10 years later, the Republic has defeated all of its enemies. We have embarked on a policy of reconciliation, at least with our French neighbors. We have been welcomed back into the family of states and the League of Nations, etc., etc. There is a lot to celebrate here. And 1 year later, then, the Great Depression kicks in. So while, of course, the Great Depression brings back to the fore some of the issues that, the Great War had raised but not solved, lingering issues, it really is kind of that unparalleled economic collapse which really creates the space for a political party like the Nazis, but also, of course, the communists, who also see a massive increase in votes, for apocalyptic politicians and demagogues to make promises without having to deliver on them, at least in the short term.
Well, on that note, we draw your current work to a close. But moving ahead, what can we look forward to from you next?
Well, I mean, I guess that the next works will be a long time in the making, because I'm only just really starting on it. I would be quite interested in writing a more general history of the Weimar Republic, which sort of takes forward some of these arguments. But I'm also very interested, and this is a much more long-term project, in writing a new history of civil wars in Europe, basically from the Balkan Wars, with its expulsion, mass expulsion of Muslim minorities from former Ottoman territories, all the way to the end of the Greek Civil War. Because I think that although we have a lot of books on individual civil wars, obviously the American Civil War, but also the Russian Civil War and many others, there's relatively little, very few attempts to kind of compare them and to ask the question why civil wars became so predominant in a period which we quite rightly, and I think for various reasons, very often associate with the two world wars, whose significance obviously has overshadowed the large variety of civil wars that were going on simultaneously. Fortunately, I have a year's research leave coming up now, since I have recently finished my term as head of department here in UCD. So I'm looking forward to getting back into the archives and getting started.
Well, we wait with bated breath, however long it may be.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Ryan. That was great to be on your show.
Well, it's been our pleasure. Well, that does it for us here at New Books in German Studies. Once again, we've been talking with Robert Gerwarth about November 1918, the German Revolution. November 1918 is available from Oxford University Press as of August 2020, and will be of interest to anyone looking for a narrative about the key element behind the revolution that laid the foundation of the Weimar Republic. Gerwarth does an excellent job. As I alluded to during the interview, he plucks out these diary entries and public pronouncements that really put you in the minds of contemporaries across the different political and social divides. So whether you're a general reader looking for the view from 30,000 feet, as it were, or you're a teacher searching for a memorable way to introduce the core conflicts that came to define Weimar, November 1918 may be just the book you're looking for. With that, I'd like to thank you for joining us and hope to see you next time. Until then.